You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 3rd of February 2022 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello, this is The Globalist, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. Coming up on today's programme...
Italy's President of the Republic, the respected Sergio Mattarella, will be sworn in again today after an excruciating 8 rounds of voting that were initially intended to find his successor.
Monocle's Chiara Ramella and La Repubblica's Enrico Franciscini will be telling us why the 80-year-old Sergio Mattarella is having to delay his retirement. Also ahead on today's programme, we explore Pakistan's relationship with China as Imran Khan arrives in Beijing for the Winter Olympics. Plus, the day's papers with Laura Walters, a roundup of headlines from the music pages, and we cross live to the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature. That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. Russia has criticised a US decision to send extra troops to Europe amid continuing fears of a Russian invasion of Ukraine. New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinta Ardern has announced a phased reopening of the country's borders. And Canada's Conservatives have voted to oust Erin O'Toole as party leader after only 18 months in the job. Do stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on those stories. Now, it took 8 ballots for Italy to elect a new president. Finally, they settled for an old one who didn't even want the job. Monocle's Chiara Ramella filed this opinion piece.
Italy's President of the Republic, the respected Sergio Mattarella, will be sworn in again today after an excruciating 8 rounds of voting that were initially intended to find his successor. After weeks of speculation, controversy and infighting, it seems that the latest Italian political drama consisted of much ado about nothing. Sound familiar? Most Italians are breathing a sigh of relief. Political scheming had landed them with some fairly implausible candidates. But the whole reason behind the search for a new president, a largely ceremonial figure supposed to guarantee respect for the constitution and act as an adjudicator in the creation of a new governing coalition, was that Mattarella no longer wanted the job. He's 80, and another 7-year mandate will see him dedicate his old age to a thankless task. This feels like a personal sacrifice afforded out of exhaustion and selflessness. His re-election is, in many ways, a disappointment. It means that the political parties were so short-sighted and self-interested that they weren't able to agree on any other name. It doesn't bode well for the remainder of the term and only portends more chaos when the next general election comes round in 2023, when another painful coalition negotiation probably beckons. It's also a kick in the teeth for those who had hoped that the future of Italian politics could become younger, fresher, different. Ursula von der Leyen praised Italy's choice of Mattarella as one of serenity and stability. It feels a lot more like stasis.
Monocle's Chiara Ramella there. Well, I'm joined now by Enrico Franciscini, London's correspondent for La Repubblica. Enrico, is this Italy just standing still?
Well, Georgina, yes, it is. It's better standing still than going backward in a way, so that we still have the same couple at the pinnacle of Italy, Mattarella as President of the Republic and Mario Draghi as Prime Minister. Originally, it was Draghi who many people thought was going to be the next president. He is the former central banker of Europe, a technocrat as widely admired in Italy, in Europe, in the world, a figure that was called to guide the government in a time of crisis, in a unity government, center-right and center-left together at the time of COVID, a time of economic crisis. And it seemed like a natural step that with elections coming, maybe have another interim prime minister and put a good arbiter, good referee in like Draghi in Quirinale, which is the home of the president in Italy. But the parties could not agree on Draghi, could not agree on anybody else. Many people said that we never had a woman president in Italy, nor prime minister, by the way. And we need someone younger, but it was impossible to find it. So in order to keep Draghi as prime minister, and because they could not find a replacement for him either, it was likely that if Draghi went to Quirinale and became president, they could not have found another prime minister without going to early election right away, losing to lose, risking to lose the billions of euros of the European Union, the recovery fund given because of the COVID crisis. So it was a mess, and it's still a mess, and it looks like now the role for Draghi will be more difficult in the last year or so before the elections.
Chiara mentioned all the political scheming that led to this decision. Berlusconi, for instance, very much involved behind, even though he withdrew his own candidacy. Can you tell us more about the backroom politics that led to this?
Yes, exactly. The first move was that quite incredible. Berlusconi himself, more than 8 years old, with all this baggage of scandals, corruption, trials, condemnations, wanted to become president. He thought it could make it. In reality, he did not have enough votes. At the end, he did withdraw the candidacy. But this opened up a Pandora box, so to speak, of backstabbing between the parties. So the center-right was divided at its between the two or three parties, the Lega, the Fratelli d'Italia, Brothers of Italy, which is a very rightist formations, and Forza Italia, the Berlusconi's party, and they could not find an agreement among them. And the center-left was divided as well between the Democratic Party, the former communist, and the Five Stars, the populist party of the left. Not even at a time of crisis it was possible to find a unifying figure, and it was a degrading show. It showed that politics in Italy has not found leaders that people like it, and it was a sorry spectacle, really. In the end, it shows that Italy needs new people, perhaps also new parties. Now, the center-right is speaking about creating a new party. They want to call it a Republican Party, like the American Republican Party, taking inspiration, unfortunately, from Donald Trump's Republican Party, so a populist party of the right, and the left does not know what to do. What's going to happen now? Well, it's possible that Mattarella will be forced to stay 7 years, but it's also possible that at the end of the legislature, when in the spring of 2023 there will be new elections, you will go earlier, like it happened before with another president who was Napolitano, who was forced to stay longer than he wanted, also more than 8 years old. And then maybe at that point Draghi will come to Quirinale, become president, and we'll see who wins the election. Very likely another coalition. And since there is so much uncertainty, it's possible another scenario that the center-left will not find anybody to present as their candidate, and they will ask Draghi to keep going and be again a unifying figure at the head of government for 4 or 5 more years.
But, I mean, we're assuming, and I hate to say this, but we're assuming that Mattarella will live for another 7 years.
Yes, exactly. And we wish him well, of course. We have had a tradition, actually, of very old presidents in Italy. It's a very old kind of democracy that we have, in which, as you see, we have a lot of 8-year-olds and very few young and women. And this is also one of the reasons that people don't feel a connection with politics. Seems like something else that happens in another planet, completely dissociated from society, from a society that in other sector shows dynamism and things are going better. We have an economy that is growing. And the key is that Mario Draghi, who is a center figure, politically speaking, is going ahead with the reforms that everybody agrees are needed to make Italy a more modern economy and a more modern democracy. But it's not nice when in the whole country depends from one man, and you don't see anybody else could replace him. And particularly, it's not nice when you need an outside figure, like a non-political figure, because politics is failing.
Enrico, thank you very much indeed. That was Enrico Francescini, the London correspondent for La Repubblica. It's 15:10 in Beijing, that's 7:10 here in London, and we turn now to Pakistan's relationship with China as Imran Khan arrives in Beijing today for the Winter Olympics, an event that's been boycotted by Western governments. While in China, the Pakistani president will meet President Xi Jinping and Premier Li Keqiang. Well, joining me now for more on this is Isabel Hilton, the CEO of China Dialogue. Isabel, lovely to have you on the programme again. Western diplomats are not attending the game because of human rights abuses committed by China. What has Imran Khan said about the suppression of the Uyghurs?
Imran Khan has said exactly nothing about the suppression of the Uyghurs in China. And in that, I have to say, he does, you know, he's pretty much in line with a lot of influential figures in Pakistan and his predecessor. So the relationship between Pakistan and China is extremely close, and it is one of the paradoxes of that relationship that a country which has such a strong Islamic identity should be silent about Xinjiang. But that has always been the case, even in the military.
Well, let's explore that relationship a little bit more, because, of course, the countries have had diplomatic relations for 70 years now.
They have, and they're extremely close. I mean, both sides describe this as an absolutely fundamental and very close relationship. And Pakistan has had to balance over time its relationship with the United States, whose attention has come and gone from the Pakistanis' perspective, depending on what interests the United States was trying to pursue or defend in the region, and the relationship with China, which is dependent on both geography and on the mutual kind of antagonism between Pakistan, China, and India, the major rival of both of them. And Pakistan certainly feels that China is an essential counterbalance to India. And Pakistan serves China's purposes by keeping Indian attention, strategic attention, pinned down with Pakistani activity and leaving China quite a lot of room to breathe. But the whole situation has changed rather dramatically in recent times because of the US withdrawal from Afghanistan, which has, you know, destabilized the region one more time.
Well, let's talk about that, because I wonder how the partnership impacts on the wider region, particularly, as you say, the instability on Pakistan's border in Afghanistan.
Well, there are a number of quite big factors to remember. One is that the Belt and Road Initiative, launched in 2013 by Xi Jinping, has as one of its major components the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, CPEC. And that runs from Western China down to a newly built or enlarged port of Gwadar. And it is meant to be an energy corridor which allows the import of energy, oil from the Gulf to Gwadar and then directly kind of up to Western China, thus cutting out the vulnerabilities involved in crossing the South China Sea and various pinch points on the way. So that's been extremely important. But it also crosses Balochistan, which is a a province of Pakistan in which there has been active insurgency against Islamabad for many years. So it's a security headache just on its own, and Chinese workers have been subject to attacks from Baluch insurgents. So it was already a problem. Mm. With the collapse of the regime in Afghanistan, which has always been a major interest. Pakistan military had a doctrine of strategic depth, which argued that should India ever invade Pakistan, Pakistan needed Afghanistan as a place of retreat and resistance. So it's been absolutely central to Pakistan's security doctrine for decades. Mm-hmm. The difficulty, of course, is that it has been extremely unstable ever since the Russian invasion of Afghanistan in 1979. Pakistan supported the Taliban. Pakistan hosts the biggest Afghan refugee groups, and the Taliban essentially emerged from those with the support of the Pakistani intelligence in order to maintain Pakistan's interests in Afghanistan. So you might think that the arrival in power of the Taliban would be welcome. But of course, the Taliban are not actually in control of Afghanistan, and we have seen the emergence of more radical groups that see as enemies both Pakistan and the Taliban. So the security situation has, if anything, worsened. And of course, China has real money in the game now. Mm. This corridor is very, very important.
And that security situation is likely to come up in the bilateral meeting with China's leaders. What else do you think will be on the table?
There are reports in the Pakistani press that that Imran Khan is also seeking a further loan of some $4 billion dollars from China. And that's the other rather contentious aspect of the relationship, that CPEC is being built and Gwadar, the port, is being developed. But the financial arrangements for this investment remain extremely opaque. And even senior officials in Pakistan have complained that they don't know the terms of these loans. They don't know the terms of the contracts. And when Pakistan gets into economic difficulties, which it does fairly regularly, and seeks loans, for example, from the IMF, the IMF tend to hang back because Pakistan won't tell them what the state of indebtedness is to China and what the terms of those loans are. So the IMF doesn't want to pour money into Pakistan only to see it used to repay Pakistani loans to China. So the dependence of Pakistan on China has grown really quite seriously. They were able to balance the United States over time with China, although China always remained the bigger player. But now I think that the concern is that Pakistan is so dependent on China for any kind of financial refreshment, let alone the security relationship, that it'll never get out of it. And China will be able to call the shots in Pakistan in ways that will generate resentment and resistance in Pakistan. At the moment, Pakistan doesn't seem to have a choice. If it needs money, where's it going to go?
Now, of course, we know that Imran Khan is a former world-class sportsman, a cricketer, and this visit does coincide with the Winter Olympics. How much of the visit is centred around sport?
Well, he's lending face to the Chinese by turning up, because the Chinese can say, well, our friends, the people we invited, the people who matter, turn up. So Putin, as we know, is going, and Imran Khan is going. It's important in terms of face because of Xinjiang. As long as leaders of major Islamic and Muslim states turn up and are seen smiling, then it rather deflates the power of other more critical parties, including the United States, to make the point about the treatment of the Uyghurs. So it's very important diplomatically. And Imran Khan, as you say, is a big sporting figure. He will turn up, and it is, a big party that China wants to demonstrate to its own population that foreign leaders are, treating China with respect. So it's an important one in terms of prestige. He will definitely be at the opening ceremony. He will definitely be making approving remarks about how wonderful the Olympics are. But the talks in Beijing, I think, are going to be pretty important too.
Isabel, thank you very much indeed. That was Isabel Hilton of China Dialogue. Still to come on today's programme, we'll have an update from Ukraine, find out why New Zealand is embarking upon the phased reopening of its borders, and we'll also check in with Dubai and the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
We head to the Balkans now, where our correspondent Guy Delaunay is standing by to unpick the situation in Montenegro. The country is braced for more political chaos ahead of a critical vote in Parliament tomorrow that may oust its Prime Minister. Guy, good morning to you and thanks for coming on. Can you fill us in on the background to this, please?
Absolutely, Georgina. I think it's best if we rewind a little to 2020. And that's when this current coalition government took power. This is December 2020. And it was historic because it was the first time in three decades that there'd been a government in Montenegro which wasn't controlled by the Democratic Party of Socialists. And this is the party of President Milo Djukanovic, who likewise has been in power one way or another for more than 30 years now. So this was a big shift. You've had finally got a government which isn't controlled by Milo Djukanovic, and the people of Montenegro had voted for this. So big things were expected of it. The problem is it's a very unstable coalition. It's made up of groups who really don't have that much in common with each other, from, for example, a large Serbian nationalist party, the Democratic Front, through to United Reform Action, which is a green left party. So they don't really have a lot in common. So what happened was a technocratic government was formed under the prime ministership of Zdravko Krivokapic, who's a former academic, and basically it hasn't been able to get anything done. Now we've got a situation where the government's got a civil war going on, where the deputy prime minister, Dritan Abazovic, has filed this no-confidence motion in the government that we're due to have in parliament tomorrow. But today, we've got a motion to sack Dritan Abazovic as deputy prime minister, and that's been brought by Prime Minister Zdravko Krivokapic. It is an unholy mess, Georgina.
It sounds extremely complicated. What do ordinary Montenegrins feel about this? Would they like a change in government?
Well, what they wanted was not the Democratic Party of Socialists. They did want a change of government. They got a change of government, but what they've ended up with is a coalition that can't do anything. And this is largely due to dysfunction on the part of the largest party in the coalition, the Democratic Front, which is largely Serb nationalist, one could say. They wanted their leading figures in government. That was resisted all the way along by Zdravko Krivokapic, who was always the prime minister designate. He insisted on this technocratic government. As a result, very little has got done. So the people of Montenegro are in a lot, I would imagine, a great degree of despair at the moment. They got finally a different government than a DPS slash Milo Djukanovic government, but it hasn't been able to achieve anything. Now you have these suggestions that there could be some sort of minority government led by Dritan Abazovic, but that would actually require the support of the Democratic Party of Socialists, which is, funnily enough, not what people voted for.
No. So what's going to happen then in Parliament over the next couple of days?
If you want some predictions, I would say that Dritan Abazovic won't be sacked as Deputy Prime Minister today because Prime Minister Krivokapic can no longer come up with a majority, bearing in mind that Dritan Abazovic and his party would not be voting in favour. In terms of the government being no confidence tomorrow, that is a lot more likely. And then we enter into really choppy and uncharted waters. You're going to end up with Zdravko Krivokapic as a caretaker prime minister until a new government can be formed. And we don't have a constitutional court at the moment to arbitrate over things because we're short of judges in Montenegro because of a lack of reform of the judiciary, because judges haven't been appointed, because the government, this coalition government, hasn't been able to get things done over the past year or so. It's utter chaos. And perhaps the best scenario would be fresh elections, but that's by no means guaranteed either.
What does this mean for the country's EU accession?
Well, partly this crisis has been brought about because of a recognition on the part of Dritan Abasovic and the United Reform Action Party that they have to move forward with the reforms that the European Union has been calling for. Montenegro is the most advanced of any of the countries of the Western Balkans in its accession negotiations with the European Union. But if it wants to go further, it's going to have to do things like reform the judiciary and root out corruption. This is very much at the heart of United Reform Action's mission. It's how they were set up. It was how they campaigned in the election. Seeing that this wasn't getting done, they've called for this minority government, which would try and push through a limited agenda over the next year to at least try and get a couple of these things sorted out before fresh elections. But as I said, it's far from guaranteed that they'll be able to do that. And if they do that, they'll have to have the support of Milo Djukanovic and the Democratic Party of Socialists.
I mean, does history teach us anything about this? If we look back pre-2020, at the 30 years before that, that was a chaotic time.
Well, it's been, as people like to say these days, a stableocracy until 2020. Milo Djukanovic was in charge, and that was that. And the country was run in large part according to the interests and what would benefit Milo Djukanovic. I mean, that's a cynical point of view, but you'll find a lot of people who would subscribe to that. We've entered this uncertainty because you no longer have this party in power, which was in power for 30 years. And of course, the president at the moment, Milo Djukanovic, is more or less sitting back and laughing about this. He says he would give his support to a minority government for a limited period of 1 year. And you think, yeah, you bet you would, because it'll probably make you and your party look better, whereas you've been voted out. I mean, when we had this result in 2020, Georgina, I thought this coalition is very unstable. It's got 41 seats out of 81 in the National Assembly. So it's on a razor edge anyway. And I just thought, well, Milo's just going to sit there, wait for them to start arguing and come in and clean up. And that looks like it's what's happening at the moment.
And how will this impact on the wider region?
Well, it's probably not going to have that much impact on the wider region in the great scheme of things. Montenegro is pretty small. It's a country of 500,000 people. It is a member of NATO, became a member of NATO quite recently. But in terms of how this has any blowback anywhere else, probably not got that sort of influence. Although speaking to somebody in Montenegro yesterday who's been involved in politics and civil society for many years, he said it's worrying how much instability there currently seems to be in the region when you've got this situation in Montenegro, ongoing shenanigans in Bosnia, still no resolution for the situation in Kosovo. It's not really a terrific time in the Western Balkans right now.
No. Guy, thank you very much indeed. That was Monocle's Balkans correspondent, Guy Delaunay. Now, here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. New Zealand's government has announced a phased reopening of the country's borders as the nation starts to ease some of the world's toughest COVID restrictions. Vaccinated citizens in Australia can go home from the 27th of February, whilst jabbed citizens elsewhere will be allowed in from the 13th of March. Canada's Conservatives have voted to oust Erin O'Toole as party leader after only 18 months in the job. 73 of the 118 Conservative parliamentarians voted to replace the man who led the party to defeat in last year's election. Candice Bergen has become the party's interim leader. And Zurich's Office of Urban Development has unveiled far-reaching plans to create spaces for new and taller high-rise buildings. The move creates room for the construction of buildings between 85 and 250 metres in height. You can read our take on it by heading to monocle.com/minute. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Ukraine's 2014 Euromaidan revolution represented a major shift in the country's politics, away from Russia, towards Europe, and also towards a more fully fledged democracy. And while Ukraine now faces down a growing threat from Russia, with a former TV personality as its president, it's easy to forget just how young Ukraine's democracy is. Oksana Syroyd, a former deputy head of parliament and current leader of the Self-Reliance Party, explains.
I joined the political party Samopomich in 2015. I came with this party to the parliament in the party list, and I actually chose them because they were okay, they were cool people, not crooks, not dependent from the oligarchs. And we were, I believe, very successful in the parliament, even though we lost the elections. But we lost the elections because, you know, people were actually, in 2019, they were so much keen to smash all politicians and to vote for, they believed, very fresh and angel-like people. It doesn't work like this, but we are still learning as the society. So we lost the elections, and it was quite a depressing moment for the political party, but we had very cool people on the local level. That's why I decided that I would stay with them until we are ready to reload for the new political season. So this is where I am. Naturally, we are, as a nation, as a political nation, we are growing up and learning how really elect, how to vote, what it means to have a representative, what it means to have the head of the state. Considering that first it was an oligarchic system and it was very sacred, you know, everybody knew that it's impossible to get to politics. Otherwise, you are very much connected with some financial groups. Then after the Revolution of Dignity, it was the space for different people to come, like those who never had connection with the oligarchs. And all of a sudden, people, like society, they realize, wow, actually, so it's not that sacred anymore. So different people can be there. And they decided to put the experiment. So to smash the whole, like the major part of the political establishment, and to vote for the photographers, for the entertainment people, for different, absolutely different kind of people. But it appeared that politics is also a profession. So there is nothing bad to be a politician. So the issue is whether you are an independent politician, whether you are dependent only on your voters or you are dependent on some financial groups. And it's still, yes, I believe that it's still something that we have to learn, that to be a politician, it's okay. It's not a shame, but what should be the criteria of accountability of the politician? This is one part of the issue. And the second is that we have very badly balanced political system that was exactly designed for these oligarchic purposes. So the president of Ukraine doesn't matter, the last man doesn't matter. So this position is not balanced. It's not accountable at all, according to the constitution. So it has a lot of authority that is not accountable. And it means the person who runs for the president can actually promise anything. And usually they do. So each of them promised to be a magician. And people vote for the magician. But eventually nobody can be a magician. That's why exactly in the mid of political cycle, people lose their trust in the president. And it goes like a vicious circle. And I believe that the only way to fix this is actually to decrease the power of the president and to make the executive more accountable before the parliament. Then it will be helpful for the whole system, and it will be helpful for also for the people to learn how to govern through the elections. Funny is that each president whose convocation is coming to the end is thinking about how to decrease the power of the successor. But each president who is just winning this position is claiming that he needs more power to do the reforms. And President Zelensky is fifth in this line, who actually is claiming that he needs more power to do the reforms. And it was never helpful that nobody learned the previous experience. But at the same time, in society, especially in the an expert community, it's already, the discussion has already started that maybe more balanced constitutional construction would be better for Ukraine. Ukraine is developing tremendously. So what we did within 8 years, I think that other countries and nations, they probably needed decades or sometimes even centuries. I understand that the world becoming quicker and the booster was too sharp, I would say, yeah? The Russian threat and the Russian aggression.
That was Oksana Syroyd in Kiev. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24. Well, it's just gone 7:35 here in London. That's 8:35 in Zurich. And we'll continue now with today's newspapers. And joining me on the line is Laura Walters, a journalist based in New Zealand. Hello to you, Laura.
Hello.
You're going to be able to say hello to many more people shortly because, as we've been reporting in our headlines, New Zealand is opening the gates.
It is a massive moment, isn't it, for New Zealand? I mean, I know that countries all around the world have gone through this, have had different border policies, but New Zealand's strict, strict coronavirus border policies have been tight and they've gone on for so long, and there have been families separated, friends separated, you know, businesses that can't get workers, people who desperately need to get in and out of the country, and it's been such a massive barrier. And of course, it's been very helpful for New Zealand to, you know, keeping COVID out of the country. But it is finally time to, like you say, open the gates. And that has just been all the news today in New Zealand. And of course, was on the front pages of the big papers this morning.
And how are they reporting on it?
Yeah, so the New Zealand Herald, which is one of our, you know, national daily papers, which is based in Auckland, you know, the largest city in New Zealand, which also has, you know, the country's big international airport where people are coming in and out of the country. They went really big on it. They've got, you know, this huge headline that says opening the gates, and then on the front page, this very emotive photo of people embracing at the airport, you know, makes you think a little bit of that movie Love Actually. And, you know, there's a lot of the papers this morning were all preview stories. And throughout the day, we've heard the announcements from the government, from the Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern. And all of the reporting has been that it is about time. You know, we all understood why these strict border rules were put in place almost 2 years ago now, but it's really gotten to that point where there's, you know, not a great argument for them anymore, and especially as the rest of the world opens up. All of the coverage today, all of the commentary has been, it is time to open up New Zealand again in a safe way, and that means no managed isolation and quarantine at the border, and, you know, quarantine hotels for people who are vaccinated, starting from the end of February in a phased reopening.
And it's going to actually have five different stages, isn't it?
Exactly. So it is, like you say, a staged reopening, and it's starting with New Zealand citizens. So New Zealand citizens and our closest neighbour, Australia, they'll have priority. They'll be able to come over without going into these border facilities from the end of February, from February 28th. Then after that, we'll be looking to New Zealand citizens from around the world. After that, we'll then be looking to people who aren't citizens but have a visa. And then by October this year, if everything does go according to plan, if this rollout, you know, happens on schedule, then New Zealand should be open to the world again, which is great news for so many people who have missed out on so much during the past couple of years.
Yeah. Now, not much missing out going on in Downing Street here, but according to all reports, of course, they've been living it up, whilst some say the police look the other way. Now, of course, the police are involved in what's been called Partygate, and many are cross that the whole report into this has been delayed because of the Metropolitan Police getting involved with it. And now there are further accusations against the police because of misogynistic and racist messages. The Guardian goes with a huge picture of Cressida Dick, who is the police commissioner, on its front page. Tell us more about this.
Yes, and you've summarised that so well there, Georgina, how these two stories, you know, we've got the police on one hand, we've got got Downing Street on the other hand, how it's all kind of converged. But you're right that there's this massive profile picture of Cressida Dick on the front page, and it is just so striking. You know, she's looking over her glasses straight down the camera lens, and you can understand why they went so big with that photo on the front and how it captures the reader's or the audience's attention there. And the headline there is warning to Met Chief, and then kind of the subhead is anger at promotion of officer and racist messages scandal. And then, you know, that's all we get on the front page. But of course, if you go into the paper, there's more about that really horrific messaging scandal. You know, we've heard about some of that content over recent days. And now there are revelations that have come out that one of the officers that was involved, that was investigated as part of this inquiry, who sent racist messages, has since been promoted. And the other part of this that is the story, I should say, that is quite, again, striking, another revelation, is that, you know, Cressida Dick, the commissioner, is really losing the confidence of London's mayor. And that's been said there, that, you know, there was basically one of those please explain meetings, those, you know, a very strong warning and a very clear warning to her that she needs to basically get her house in order, get things back on track, no more scandals, no more missteps, or, you know, she could be out, even though, you know, she's meant to be extended that period that she's in the top job there. You know, that might not happen if things continue to go as badly as they have been.
Now, one of the reasons that people are so very angry is the policing of the vigil that was held to mark the murder of Sarah Everard, during which several women who were there peacefully were arrested. Very striking photographs of that went all over the world. Interestingly, the same police officers who were in charge of that vigil are also in charge of looking at the Downing Street parties. That's not going down well, is it?
Oh, no, of course not. I mean, these things are still so fresh in your mind. It seems almost like one scandal rolls into the next scandal. And it's that credibility, you know, that trust, that credibility that you absolutely have to have in your police, that you have to have in your leaders there. And that's just been eroded time and time again over the past 12 months or so. And like you say, that Sarah Everard case is still so fresh in our minds. And those photos of the woman being, you know, handcuffed and detained there. I do very much feel like the police have a long way to go to regain the trust of the public and, of course, you know, those above them as well.
Mm. Now, if anybody doubts the veracity of these racist and misogynist messages, there's a great episode of Meet the Writers in which I spoke to Palm Sandu, who was a very senior, in fact, I think the most senior policewoman of colour. She's written a book called Black and Blue, and it really is about how she felt hounded out by that kind of behaviour from male officers. Let's move on to our last story. It's awful, but it's also, well, I'm not going to say funny. It's awful. Tell us about the hamsters.
Yeah, we're taking a bit of a change in tone here. You're right. It's awful, but I guess any animal story has a bit of a different feel to it, doesn't it? So I had a look at the South China Morning Post this morning, and of course the front page is all COVID and Lunar New Year. But the story that caught my attention was one with the headline, "Hamster Owners Dump Pets to Die After Cull Order." And I don't know whether I've been living under a rock, but somehow I missed the story about how hamsters have been found in Hong Kong to be testing positive with COVID. And there are some studies now that are saying that there could be coronavirus passed between hamsters and humans. And the government acted really swiftly. Of course, you know, when we think about the origins of the coronavirus, you know, you don't want to risk things happening again. So the government government acted swiftly. They made a ruling to cull all of the hamsters that had been imported into Hong Kong since the 22nd of December, so more than 2,000 hamsters. But, you know, now that's kind of wrapped up and pet shops are back to selling their hamsters, but owners are freaking out. So people are just in cages dumping their hamsters around Hong Kong. You know, they're leaving them by rubbish bins, they're leaving them in bushes, and these animal activists are saying, please stop dumping your hamsters, you know, in their cages without food and water. So it's just another, I guess, bizarre story to come out of COVID-19.
And I mean, what happens if the hamsters are loose and start breeding and there's an infestation of possibly COVID-ridden hamsters? I can feel a kind of zombie-like movie coming on.
I mean, that sounds absolutely terrifying to me. I felt a little bit safer hearing that most of them were still in their cages. But as you say, the last thing you want are COVID-infected hamsters taking over Hong Kong. It does sound like something from a movie.
Laura, thank you very much indeed. That was journalist Laura Walters there. And this is The Globalist on Monocle 24.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Well, it's time now to have a look at the latest news from the world of music. And I'm joined by Will Hodgkinson, who is the rock and pop critic at The Times. Good morning to you, Will.
Good morning.
Now, in the great Venn diagram of podcast listenership, I expect that there's very little intersection between Monocle 24 listeners and Joe Rogan listeners, and even less intersection between Neil Young and Joni Mitchell listeners and Joe Rogan listeners. Nevertheless, this is what's at the absolute heart of the Spotify row. I think if you could start by just saying who Joe Rogan is and why he's so controversial.
Sure. Well, Joe Rogan is an American comedian and a very, very successful podcaster who has something like 11 million monthly listeners. Spotify paid him something like $100 million to do these regular podcasts, where he sort of looks at frontier thinking, and he's a sort of open-minded libertarian guy who drinks magic mushroom tea every morning and explores the outer reaches of conspiracy theories. And he has very, very controversial people like Alex Jones, who's the guy that denied the Sandy Hook massacre, if you remember him. And, you know, he'll also have more, conventional figures. I think Louis Theroux's been on there. But he has been pushing a lot of ideas about alternative COVID theories and, you know, questioning vaccines and so on. Now, of course, this comes at a very sensitive time. I think he was looking at the value of ivermectin. None of this is particularly backed up by science, or at least not establishment science. So Neil Young initially was the figure who said, right, well, it's him or me. And of course, Spotify, you know, which is basically a business, said it's him. And so Neil Young's music went off Spotify. But the thing is, it started a bit of an avalanche. The next person was Joni Mitchell. And news has just come through, I think last night, that Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, who basically haven't talked to each other hardly for, you know, the last two decades, have united with Neil, saying, you know, this is, you know, we can't have misinformation and, you know, we want our music on Spotify too.
Mm. The point is, though, as you say, Joe Rogan has millions and millions of listeners. What would it take? What would need to be the stature of an artist who could take him on? Because, you know, as we know, people that listen to Joni Mitchell are probably not those listening to Joe Rogan.
That's right. But, ultimately Spotify is a business and they're going to go where the money is. What could happen is that you could start seeing people like Taylor Swift. You know, I think it's going to take a lot for Ed Sheeran to remove his music, but, you know, you could start seeing those very, very big, the biggest names of people like Drake, Taylor Swift, Ed Sheeran, Puerto Rican rapper Bad Bunny, if they start protesting. But the thing is that it's uncovered a bigger battle, which has been waging a long time on Spotify, which is all about the money, you know, where it all goes and how come most artists aren't earning anything from Spotify from having millions of streams. That's a whole different thing, but it's kind of fed into it. So in a way, this has been the touchstone for a big kind of moral questioning on the role Spotify plays and the way it plays it.
I mean, what about Adele? Might she be one to walk away, and would she then take a substantial amount of listeners with her?
Well, Adele is, you know, pretty much the biggest singer on the planet. If she left, she'd take a huge amount of listeners with her. I don't see that happening at the moment. But, you know, you don't know. It's also, you know, a lot of this is about the way the wind blows, you know, and it's about public mood. And if it's, you know, Joe Rogan's hugely popular, but if the kind of the right-thinking musical community don't want to be seen to be supporting, you know, Spotify because of their financial support of Joe Rogan, it's worth, you know, pointing out that they pay him a lot of money. They don't pay artists. They just license their music. It could happen. I mean, it's going to be a bigger question about, you know, the Spotify's financial model. I think the Joe Rogan thing has just begun the conversation.
Let's continue talking about Adele, because as we know, she very tearfully cancelled her Las Vegas shows, but she's flown over for the Brits and to do television appearances. Tell us more about this.
Yeah, very, very tearfully cancelled and then very happily announced that she's jetting over. It just doesn't look too good as far as I mean, you know, it's great for the Brits. It's great. You know, this was the place where Adele really broke through, I think, in 2011 when she, you know, she performed Someone Like You with a sort of single solitary tear coming down her cheek and, you know, a world was entranced. So it's fantastic for them. It's great that she's doing it. She's doing Graham Norton. But, you know, this comes on the back of cancelling an entire run of shows in Las Vegas. Apparently, really because she was having a lot of battles with Ez Devlin, who's the set designer. And, you know, pulled it at the last minute, which means, as we all know, if you could cancel within 24 hours, it's very difficult for fans to get things like flights and, you know, hotels refunded. So it's a huge amount of money. And I just think it didn't look good because it kind of looks like she's prepared to do award ceremonies. She did at the London Palladium in November. She did a concert in front of entirely made up of, you know, sort of A-list celebrities like Idris Elba and you know, and so on. And so it looks a bit like she's, you know, this is the woman of the people. And the people seem to be not at the top of her list of priorities right now.
And then very quickly, a look at what you did last night. The band of the moment, Wet Leg, with their cottagecore aesthetic. Tell us how that went.
Wet Leg was so much fun. I mean, people might have come across them from Song Called Chaise Longue, which is basically about, you know, getting a D at university, coming back to your mum and dad's house and, you know, lounging about on the chaise longue. Although maybe even that's reading too much into it. It's just a kind of fun bit of nonsense. And it took off last year. Absolutely brilliant song. And this is there's two women and three kind of hairy blokes in the back. And it was at the 100 Club. And it made me feel that every time people write guitar bands off, someone comes along and revives the whole genre and makes it exciting again. It happened with the Beatles, actually. Then it happened with the Stone Roses. It happened with the Strokes. And it happened with Wet Leg. It was fun. The music was kind of straightforward. You know, it wasn't complicated, but really, really good songs. And everyone was going crazy. And they're just a fun band, you know, really, really good. And they look great and they had a great attitude and the whole thing was a real laugh. So I think Wet Leg is going to do really well this year.
Will, thank you very much indeed. That was Will Hodgkinson of The Times. And this is The Globalist on Monocle 24. The Emirates Airline Festival of Literature, launched in 2009, is the Arab world's largest celebration of the written and spoken word. The annual event takes place in Dubai and it opens today, running until the 13th of February. Well, I'm joined on the line now by the director, Alam Bolouki. Alam, lovely to talk to you again. Can you tell us the history of the festival?
Hi, Georgina. It's great to be on the show. Yes, so the festival started in 2009 by our CEO and trustee, Isabel Abulhol, who actually moved to the UAE in the 60s from Cambridge at the age of 18. Her husband is Emirati, her children are Emirati. She started one of the first bookshops here in the UAE, Magoudi's, and after knowing what everybody loved to read here in Dubai, she started this literary festival, which started off as a small idea, picked up in 2009, and today, we are 14 years in the Arab world's largest celebration of the written and spoken word.
And there's a charitable element to it too.
Absolutely. So the festival is run by an independent nonprofit organization called the Emirates Literature Foundation. And, we have a mandate of encouraging and spreading the love of reading throughout the region. And we make sure that literature is accessible to all. We've got a wonderful Reading for Pleasure program that goes to all of the public schools that we work on. We have a program where we work with Dubai Prison and send authors in to work with the inmates to use that time in there as a recreational time. And we really try to use literature and present it in a way that it really shows the light to all aspects of society. And the festival over here as well, we have a lot of free sessions taking place, and we do sell tickets, but the tickets are very accessible and affordable to all.
Now, we know that the region and the UAE has a vibrant tradition of storytelling and of publishing, lots and lots of local authors coming to the festival. You also feature some international guests. Who are they this year?
Absolutely. We have so many, and it just happens that a lot of our authors actually have had film adaptations also. So we've got Julia Quinn here, the author of the Bridgerton series. We have Sarah Gay Forden, who wrote the book of The House of Gucci. We've got Serhi Plochy, who wrote the book which the Chernobyl series was based on. We've got an amazing children's author, Ben Miller here, David Walliams, back by popular demand. And so many more. We've got Indra Nui, the ex-chairperson of PepsiCo, here speaking about her journey, and many, many other names. Dr. Rupi Aujla, is Doctor's Kitchen. So we feature a really lovely mix of fiction, nonfiction, all sorts of topics, because we want to make sure that the festival is accessible to all, not only readers, but anyone with any interest can find something that they are looking for here at the festival.
Now, the event lasts 2 weeks. That's quite a long time for a literary festival. Are there events every day? Mm-hmm.
There are the main events morning to night take place on the Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And then during the week, there are events every day, but they're mainly in the evening, or they might be our education sessions that we do for schools or for our partners. So we do have activities going on all week, but the main morning to night programming is over the weekends.
Mm-hmm. And the festival's changed sites. Where is it held this year?
This year it's held at the Habtour City in Sheikh Zayed Road. It's a lovely Al Jud ballrooms where the Hilton Hotel is. And we have some of the events also taking place next door at the Habtour Palace. It's a lovely hotel complex here. We're also doing a couple of events at the World Expo. As you know, Dubai is hosting this year. And we will also be going out into the desert on the 8th evening, like we always do, for a lovely lineup of poets from all over the world.
No, absolutely. I remember that event with such fondness, reading a poem there under the desert lit up by the moon and riding a camel too. Thank you so much. Good luck with it all. I know it starts today. That's Alam Baluki and the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature in Dubai, as I say, opens today and it runs until the 13th of February. And that's all we have time for on today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Rhys James, Charlie Filmer-Court and Emma Searle, our researcher, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, and our studio manager, Chris Oblakwa. After the headlines, there's more music on the way, and then The Briefing is live at midday in London. Of course, lots of sharp programming and great music to come all day here on Monocle 24. The Globalist will return at the same time tomorrow. I'll be presenting then too. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thanks for listening.